This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Look, no offense to Santa and his reindeer, but he ain't the only one who spreads Christmas cheer.
Hi, my name is Daisy, and I'm from Olympia, Washington, and I am a current postal office worker. I'm a carrier, otherwise known as a CCA, so I basically help out other carriers with all of their parcels during the Christmas season. And to say it's crazy is an understatement. We get about 6,000 packages in the morning, I would think, and then more at night. I work about 12-hour days for 6 weeks.
And Daisy is not alone. This week, the U.S. Postal Service will deliver nearly 200 million packages. This week, between Thanksgiving and New Year's Day, postal workers will deliver nearly 15 billion pieces of mail and almost a billion packages. It's an essential service with some major challenges. The Postal Service has run a multi-billion dollar deficit for some time now. It also has a range of financial obligations that can make it harder to turn a profit. Is today's post office sustainable? Would you miss it if it shrank or if it went away? And if it is worth saving, how should we save it? Joining us to discuss it is Jim Tankersley, the economic and tax reporter for the New York Times. Jim, welcome to 1A.
Thanks so much for having me.
Here with us in studio is Mark Dimenstein, the president of the American Postal Workers Union. It represents more than 200,000 postal employees, including mail sorters, post office staff, truck drivers, and IT workers. Mark, welcome.
Great to be here, Joshua. Thank you.
Also in studio is Robert Reisner, a management consultant at Guidehouse. He is a former vice president of the Postal Service in technological application and strategic planning. Bob, great to have you with us.
It's great to be here. Thank you very much.
We also welcome your questions and thoughts about the future of the U.S. Postal Service. We'd love to hear from you if you are or were a postal worker. What do you see from the inside in terms of some of the challenges that the post office faces and what might be done about them? Email us, 1A@WAMU.org. Comment on our Facebook page or tweet us at 1A. Bob, let me start with you. The post office is a pretty incredible entity, and some of our listeners certainly feel that way. Here is a mashup of some of what our listeners left in our inbox.
My name is James, and I'm from Connecticut.
This is Ed Getz. I live in Ossian, Indiana.
It's Jeffrey. I'm calling from Sarasota, Florida.
They are the most reliable federal agency I can think of.
For only 50 cents, you can send a letter from your address to any address in the country for a half a buck. You can't buy anything else in the world for a half a buck.
The United States Post Office is my connection with the world. I'm 97 years old.
And letter carriers are also sometimes the eyes and ears of our neighborhoods and our streets.
While FedEx and UPS are real, real good, there's just a friendly level that the post office delivers.
My mail delivery person comes into the house to hand me the mail, and I really enjoy meeting the postal delivery people.
There's no greater federal agency, in my opinion, than the U.S. Postal Service.
Well, thank you, James and Ed and Jeffrey, for sharing your thoughts about the post office. And Bob, I think it's just worth saying off the top, there are other post offices around the world, but there's really nothing else in American life that compares to the U.S. Postal Service.
Nor in the world. The size of the Postal Service is 40% of the world's mail.
40%?
That's right.
In this one agency?
That's right. And it is an extraordinary point of contact with the entire country. It's a great place to start with those voices, because the mission of the Postal Service is to tie the nation together, to bind the nation together through the correspondence of the people. And yep, that network still exists.
Yeah, Mark Dimenstein, I was just going to get to you with that, is in terms of the members of the American Postal Workers Union, how they see their mission, how they see their mandate.
Postal workers of all crafts, and there's four postal unions, we're one of the four, are extremely dedicated to the mission of serving the people of the country. And it was very interesting listening to those many voices, because it underscores what an amazing entity. We call the post office a national treasure, and those voices did reflect that. Here you have 157 million U.S. addresses that the Postal Service and the postal workers delivered to 6 days a week, now sometimes 7 days a week, everywhere in the country, from the urban centers to the most rural, remote outposts. And 1 million new addresses a year. And that's the universal service. That's the mission at a uniform rate for everybody. It belongs to the people. It's based in the Constitution. It runs without tax dollars. So it's a wonderful entity, and we want to keep it strong and robust going into the future.
Glad you made that point that the founding fathers did intend for Congress to establish postal routes and a postal carriage service as part of the Constitution. We're also hearing from some of you who are mail carriers. Jillian has been a mail carrier for 5 years, and Jillian emails, I have about 450 delivery points, and I know the names and pets of about 90% of them. Some of the things I have done for my customers in the last month include helping a latchkey kid with a sticky door lock, telling a customer they left the lights of their car on, shepherding a lost, friendly dog back home, teaching an elderly customer how to turn their new cell phone on and off, and most importantly, checking on and chatting with my elderly customers, many of whom I am the only person that they see on a daily basis. Jim Tankersley, obviously, this is a service that many millions of Americans take very seriously, part of our communities for sure. Give us a sense of how the Postal Service is doing these days. We hear a lot about the financial troubles, but can you paint that picture a little clearer for us?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the Postal Service has been losing money for a decade and is projected to keep doing that. It's an absolute problem of technology changing the world we live in. It's people just don't send first class mail as much anymore. And so the revenues for the Postal Service from people sending letters to each other have fallen, even as revenues from package delivery from people ordering things online have risen.
Now, the president convened a task force under the Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, to look at the sustainability of the Postal Service. Those findings came out last week. We should note we invited both the Treasury Secretary, Mr. Mnuchin, and the Postmaster General, Megan Brennan, to join us for this conversation. Both declined, but those invitations stand. Jim, give us a sense of what the big recommendations were in this federal report.
Well, it's a sprawling report that attempts to address, you know, sort of sustainability issues of the Postal Service. And it gets at a whole bunch of different ways in which you could reorient the service, reorganize the business model in an attempt to, you know, make the books balance. Some of the biggest ones are the ability to give the Postal Service the power to reduce the number of days that it delivers mail, for example, down to 5. It would allow it to eliminate caps on the increase in first-class mail rates, so you could charge people a lot more to send letters to one another. And then there's a bunch of technical recommendations about what it might do with pricing for packages, what it might do with labor contracts, what it might do with what's called the universal service obligation, which is basically what things the Postal Service is obligated to deliver and what things it's not. And in this really long report, basically attempts to make the case for a package of changes that would, the report claims, help balance the books over time.
Before I get reactions from Mark and Bob, we did get an email in our inbox with regards to the future of the post office. Listen.
My name is Donald. I'm from Indiana. I'm a member of the Postal Service. First off, I want to say thank you, Amazon, because we love their business. The post office can survive. Congress would just let us do our job.
Donald, thanks for calling in. Jim, before I bring it back to our guests here in studio, the president has claimed that Amazon is using the Postal Service as, in his words, its delivery boy, and that the U.S. Postal Service should be charging them much more to deliver packages. What did this federal report say about how Amazon factors into all of this?
Well, the federal report, without saying as much explicitly, totally contradicts the president about the idea that Amazon is costing taxpayers money. In fact, what it says is Amazon and other e-commerce retailers are subsidizing the lost revenues from, again, first-class mail. But what the report also says is that perhaps the Postal Service should be pricing package delivery not to maximize the number of packages that it delivers, but the profits that it makes on each package that it delivers, which, if you read between the lines, means that they think that the service could be charging Amazon and other retailers more to deliver their packages, even if that means they get less business out of it because they'd make more money.
Let me get some reaction from Robert Reisner and Mark Dimenstein. Bob, what were your reactions to this federal report?
Well, there certainly are parts of it that say interesting things. The Congress is going to have to act in order to implement most of it. But it's another contribution to the conversation. Here's the thing, that the report helps us look toward the future rather than only toward the past. And one of the things that was just mentioned there is Amazon's extraordinary changes that they brought to the market. There are others as well. There's a couple of years ago, I did a panel called The Coming Fight for Your Front Door. And it's about the amazing amount of change that's taking place in front of all of our houses as Amazon and other competitors are there, and as the Postal Service takes advantage of the opportunity of what's essentially a second digital revolution. There may be an opportunity to add value in a time of extraordinary change.
Mark, I want to make sure you have enough time to share your thoughts. We have to pause in just a moment. So let me get to one of our listeners' comments, and then I'll get to you on the other side. Jan wrote, "Last week when there was a federal holiday mourning President George H.W. Bush, I ran into my mailman and another one who were both delivering packages on their day off. They volunteered to work because the post office is slammed with deliveries this time of year. I'm impressed by their dedication as public servants." Much more to discuss as we continue with Jim Tankersley of the New York Times, Bob Reisner, a former vice president of the Postal Service, and Mark Demenstein, president of the American Postal Workers Union. We'll also get some answers to some of your questions. Rick tweeted, "Why do we start with this presumption that the Postal Service should be a profit center anyway? Is Congress a profit center?" I'm Joshua Johnson. Glad to be with you. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're delivering the latest on the U.S. Postal Service and its potential future with Jim Tankersley of the New York Times, Bob Reisner, a former vice president of the USPS, and Mark Demenstein, president of the American Postal Workers Union. We'd love to hear from you, too. How do you view the Postal Service? Is it this bedrock institution that you rely on, a department in need of a big overhaul, maybe a little bit of both? Also, if you are or have been a postal employee, we'd love you to share what you know about the current state of the post office and maybe what could be done to make it more sustainable for the future. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A or email 1A@WAMU.org. Before we get to more of your comments, Mark Demenstein, let me get your reactions to that federal report we mentioned a minute ago.
Joshua, in general, we think it's poorly conceived. We think that many of its recommendations are based on misinformation and maybe some myths. And if implemented, rather than improving services, we think it would cause less service at higher prices. And, of course, it would also lead to less wages and benefits for the postal workers. And we believe in good family-sustaining jobs and community-building jobs. But I do want to address very quickly the question of the very premise for the report was the idea that the post office is hemorrhaging money. And we heard that earlier in the segment. The financial condition of the post office is largely due to a 2006 law that caused and forced the post office to pre-fund retiree health benefits 75 years into the future. No other company, no other agency has to do that, and it's an absurd burden. It's a burden the post office could not meet. So, yes, mail's changing. Technology's changing. We have a comment that the Internet taketh and the Internet giveth. So first-class mail is down, packages are way up, but the fundamental problem on the finances was a manufactured crisis, and therefore the very premise of the report is based on a lot of misinformation and myth.
I do want to get back to that pre-funding of retirement. I want to explain what that is and kind of dig into what that might mean. We got a voicemail from a listener to that effect, which we'll get to in just a moment. I would like to get a response to Rick's tweet. Rick writes, "Why do we start with this presumption that the Postal Service should be a profit center anyway? Is Congress a profit center?" Bob Reisner, maybe you can respond to this. I mean, I know there are many things that we as a society fund and don't expect it to make money. We kind of just know that we have to support this thing for it to be there for us, for it to be a service that's available. By the way, have you contributed to your local public radio station? You have? Good. So I kind of wonder where this presumption comes from that the post office is supposed to be a profit center. Is it?
No, it's not. In by the law, it's supposed to break even. And it works on very narrow margins. And that's the reason that the decline in mail volume was such a difficult burden to handle, because with as volume declined and declined rapidly in the late in around 2008, that meant that the costs were there, and the costs are much harder to work down. The report keeps coming back to that point, though, Joshua, and that's a valuable point, that the costs and the revenue have to match, that it's not something that can be subsidized. And I think Mark makes a good point that it was the reform law that created this hemorrhaging of loss over time.
So perhaps the difference in thinking of it, rather than thinking of the post office as something that has to be profitable, maybe sustainable is a better word than profitable?
I think so.
Now, there's this idea of the universal service obligation. Before we get too much farther, Bob, what is the universal service obligation?
Well, it means reaching every house, every business in America. It's the idea that the delivery points include everybody. It also means providing postal services to every community in America. And that has a lot to do with providing post offices. So there are a lot of dimensions to universal service, the speed of delivery, the frequency of delivery, and a number of other things. But the basic idea is that everyone can have postal services.
We've heard from quite a few of you about the nature of this universal service obligation, particularly in more remote parts of the country. Paul in Missouri writes, "The Postal Service is required to service all of America regardless of remoteness. I live in a rural area, and I am worried that if it were privatized, I would get poor service and higher fees, similar to internet. Low population density equals poor, slow, and expensive product." Now, Mark, just so we're clear, this universal service obligation, is this a standard? Is it the law? Is it just the way we've done business? Like, is there a line in the U.S. code that I can point to that says this is the universal service obligation, or is it a little more nebulous than that?
I should have brought my attorney with me, Joshua. As my understanding is, it is the law, and it's the mission. And it shows, it underscores what a great equalizer the post office is and what a democratic right it is, no matter who we are, where we live, whatever our income, whatever our geographic area, and so on and so forth. We have an equal right to the same service, basically at the same price. It's very interesting listening to the last comment from somebody that lives in rural America. There's a postal carrier route that every day drives 185 miles to deliver their rural route.
One route, 185 miles.
Every day.
Wow.
So there's no way, if this became a profit center, so to speak, like we talked about earlier, that anybody could make a profit doing that. But if it's a public service and a public right and a democratic right, then it's there for everybody.
That's like New York, almost New York to D.C. every single day, 185 miles.
Right. Almost.
Yeah.
Wouldn't quite get you there. Maybe Newark.
Oh, you might get just to Newark, and then you could take Amtrak in, another company that bears conversation one day. With regards to the post office, Jim, I wonder if you could answer this question from Patrick. Patrick tweeted, "I thought that as a charter company of the United States that the post office was a private company. Can you set me straight on this point?" Jim, it's not a private company, is it?
Well, it's sort of quasi-private, I guess I would call it. I mean, it is not private in that it is bound by all these rules that Congress sets that are very different from what, you know, UPS or FedEx face. And I think that's part of what is going on here, and part of what this report is addressing are some of those rules holding it back from actually being competitive in the market. On the other hand, the report is very clear that it does not want to subsidize the post office or to allow the post office to undercut more, you know, private competitors like those delivery services I just mentioned. And so there is this weird tension in the way that both the law treats the Postal Service and that the Trump administration wants to change the law to treat the Postal Service moving forward.
A good number of you who commented on the Postal Service have some critiques of the post office. Here is another mashup of some of what you left in our inbox.
I have been to 3 or 4 post offices around where I live, and quite frankly, each one of them are terrible service. The people are rude. They're slow. They don't seem to have any interest in helping any of the customers. And so I truly go out of my way to go to UPS, who are always willing and happy to help me. If I can avoid the U.S. Post Office, I do at all causes.
I worked there long enough to realize that a good chunk of the mail is just junk mail. It's just all advertisement, junk. It's a waste of time and a waste of fuel, waste of energy, waste of everybody's attention.
So those are two listeners who have some critiques of the post office. We'll get to the clip from rural listeners in just a moment. Bob Reasoner, I'd love you to react to some of that, though. We did hear from some listeners about things they think the post office could do differently, including junk mail. Martha tweeted, "Why doesn't USPS charge more for junk mail? I don't need 99.9% of what comes through my mail slot. If it's so valuable for businesses to reach me directly, why not charge them more?"
Well, first of all, as a general proposition, giving the Postal Service more flexibility in the way in which it prices, which is something that the task force report recommended, is not a bad idea, because the matching of costs and prices, more freedom to control costs, more freedom to be flexible in pricing, is a good idea, and it's something that would be valuable. But let's understand that these customers may not all have the same opinion, and there's a competitive marketplace, and which is a great idea to have such a thing.
Mark, what about this idea of charging different rates for, say, junk mail or different kinds of mail?
Well, we don't think there's such a thing as junk mail.
No such thing as junk mail?
No such thing. What somebody think is unnecessary, somebody may look at it as a lifeline. So we don't accept the term that it's junk. It's mail that people get. It deals with commerce. It deals with certainly an exchange of information. Somebody may think it's junk mail to get the faith-based church bulletin. Others look at it as very valuable. Somebody might think it's junk mail to get a catalog. Somebody else looks at their way of doing commerce and business with the rest of the world. Some people may think it's junk mail to get a political flyer and during an election campaign. Others value it. So the customer can be the one that decides what's best for them. Now, you know, we look at all mail as of having some value, and obviously most of the customers feel that way. In terms of people that have a bad experience at the post office, the post office is rated over and over and over as the highest, most favorably rated government agency. Up to 88% of the people of the country feel that its service is either good or excellent. You're going to have pockets of problems anywhere, and some of those problems are caused by the financial manufacturing crisis that I spoke of earlier. It can lead to understaffing. It can lead to more stress on the part of the workers, and therefore less time for good customer service. So we certainly don't like to hear those problems, but generally the post office, especially if they're properly funded, does a great job that the people of this country value.
We do hear from several of you who do believe that the post office, by and large, does a very good job. Greta in Arlington emailed, "I've lived in several countries in Asia, Europe, and the Middle East where nothing compares to the U.S. Postal Service. I hope our letter carriers know that they are the world's gold standard because of their reach and reliability." And Jack writes, "My father was walked back to his home by the postal carrier who recognized my father, knew he had dementia, and could not find his way home." I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Jim, I know we're going to lose you in just a minute, but I do want to talk to you about some of these concerns with regards to the future of the post office. We did hear from a number of listeners in rural areas. Here's some of what they left in our inbox.
My name is Larry, and I live in Asheville, North Carolina.
My name is Linda, and I live in Eastern Virginia.
This is Jonathan from Reno, Nevada.
Private enterprise is not going to take a piece of junk mail up and down these mountain roads out in the rural areas for 50 cents.
We are now living in a very rural area. The post office here is a community center. We go in every day to pick up our mail from a box. And we see people we know. We hear news about the town.
I work for the National Park Service, and I often live in areas that are several hours away from town without cellular service or Wi-Fi. And the post service is often the only way to keep me connected to my friends and family.
Thank you, Jonathan and Linda and Larry, all with concerns about the future of the post office in rural areas. One long-held fear is that the government will privatize the post office. Now, Jim, that was not mentioned in this report, but can you just kind of give us a little bit more of the background of what that concern is?
Sure, yeah. I mean, the worry is that if the government were to truly and fully privatize the Postal Service and end this service obligation, then, you know, you could have the recently privatized company come in and say, hey, this part of the business does not make money for us, so are not going to be delivering there. I would just really make sure to note that that does not appear to be on the table at all, and that it's hard to imagine that with the makeup of Congress, as it currently is constructed, or even in any reasonable foreseeable future, it's just hard to see that, I think. It's not just that particular thing. It's anything almost that would hurt rural areas. You're going to get a lot of opposition in Congress. And it's also worth noting that the recommendations of this report from the administration have to, most of them, go through Congress or go through the leadership of the Postal Service to be implemented. And it seems unlikely that almost any of these changes are going to be put in place right away or anytime soon. But again, in particular, the threats to rural areas would seem to be very, very faint in political terms.
Bob, there are a few precedents around the world in terms of privatization. Germany privatized its postal service in 1994. Austria privatized in 99. The UK's post went private 5 years ago. It then had the opportunity to make new funds and innovate and still deliver mail. What about the U.S. Postal Service? Should that at least be on the table as an option, or is the USPS a special case?
Well, I think the first thing is to look at some of the experiences that some of those privatized posts have had, that the ones that have been the most successful have been closely connected to a government mission that the government really never let go. It wasn't as if they turned over the Postal Service and just let it go from there. And the ones that, and others have struggled. What in this country, given the geography and given some of the challenges, nothing is going to happen quickly. And I think that it can be a scare word that can end the conversation. And what we need to do, instead of thinking about this all or nothing privatization kind of boogeyman, is be thinking more about how can this be a hinge point to connect the postal services that we know are valuable and that people have been talking about today as very valuable with some of the technologies that can make them more effective.
Mark, what do you think?
Joshua, first I think it's a mistake to look at this December 4th task force report and say it doesn't address privatization at all. It cannot be looked at in isolation from an early report from the White House Office of Management and Budget that came out on June 21st. In the Office of Management Budget report, they advocated open, total, and wholesale privatization, i.e., selling the post office to private corporate interests to make private profit. In that report, though, in June, they raised a two-stage process. The first stage was to make it, quotes, more profitable, the Postal Service more profitable. And the second stage was to sell it. I would submit to the listeners that the December 4th task force report is indeed the attempt at the first stage. Lower wages, raise prices, fatten it up, and get it ready for the auction block. So we are very concerned that this whole report, the task force report, is a big step towards privatization, which would greatly harm the people of this country.
Before we have to let you go, Jim, what's the next step from here? Is there an end game that we're looking at? Bailouts, privatization? What's the next move?
I think the next move, the next step, the end game for this issue in Congress is the same as a lot of issues facing the divided Congress moving forward, which is probably very little. The administration released this report in the middle of a week with funeral services going on for former President Bush. It does not appear that this is anywhere close to the top of its agenda. And again, it doesn't match up with what the president was complaining about in his tweets all year about Amazon. Mm-hmm. So I have yet to talk to anybody who thinks that any of this is going anywhere anytime soon.
Jim Tankersley, economics and tax policy reporter at The New York Times. Jim, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll get to more of your questions in just a moment. We'll talk about that pre-funding of retirement, and we will wind back the clock to a time where people sent all kinds of things through the mail, including their children. Stay close. Before we get back to our conversation, we would love your help with tomorrow's program. We'll take a closer look at a dramatic investigation by the Miami Herald. It detailed how a multimillionaire in Palm Beach worked his connections to ease a sentence for sex crimes. Those connections included Alexander Acosta, the former top prosecutor in Miami. Today, Mr. Acosta is the Secretary of Labor. We welcome your questions about this investigation, so leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. We would especially love to hear from you if you have connections to Jeffrey Epstein or Secretary Acosta. Tell us your story, 855-236-1A1A. And we understand if you might need to leave certain personal details out, but we would love to hear from you, 855-236-1A1A, or you can use our app, 1A Vox Pop, to send us a radio-quality audio file. We'll share some of your questions and stories with Miami Herald reporter Julie Brown tomorrow on 1A. Back now to our conversation with Mark Dimenstein and Bob Reasoner. Still a little bit more time to get in some of your questions and thoughts, including those of you who have direct personal connections to the post office. Nikki tweeted, "My son just began working for USPS, a 25-year-old with no college education. This is a good job with benefits and a living wage, a rare opportunity in today's workforce to support yourself and advance, as well as secure your retirement. Privatization would surely end that." Hal in New York writes, "Stop the manufactured crisis. I think it is criminal that the USPS has to prepay retirement for postal workers. What business has to do that? The financial condition is due to this 2006 law." That pre-retirement was the subject of several of your comments, including one from Wendy in Bay City, Michigan. Here's what Wendy left in our inbox.
"On December 7, 2006, Congress passed a bill, H.R. 6407, which required the United States Post Office to pre-fund $5.5 billion to cover retirement and health benefits for employees for the next 75 years. No other public agency has been required to pre-fund employees who had not even yet been born. This poison pill was designed to wreck the post office so it could be privatized for profit."
Wendy, thanks very much for sharing your thoughts with us. Bob, I'd love for you to explain some of the rationale, at least, behind this pre-funding. We know that retirement and pension liabilities have bedeviled all kinds of public agencies, cities, counties, state governments, for a while, and those liabilities are continuing to grow. What's wrong with setting some money aside to deal with those liabilities in the future?
Well, I think that was what Congress was thinking at the time. And I think that up until that moment, mail volume had been either level or had been increasing. What happened almost immediately after passing that law was we began to see volume declines, and it became impossible for the Postal Service to keep pace with what everyone had hoped for. I'm certain that working out the retiree health benefits and the pension payments would be the Postmaster General Megan Brennan's, the top of her Christmas list, if Congress would take that on and really work through that difficult problem.
So, Mark, if not pre-funding retirements, what does your organization think would be a better way about it?
Well, let me just say first, Wendy hit the nail right in the head as far as I am concerned. Look, and let me just clear up. It's not, the pre-funding is for retiree health benefits. The retirement plans, of which there are two, that the post office is part of, are very, very well funded, somewhere in the 90% range. Highly unusual. Well funded. No problems there. The retiree health benefits is already pre-funded at $50 billion. Nobody has that. No, not only public agency, no private company. That's a burden you pay as you go, a benefit that you pay as you go. And it really helped defund in a manufactured way the postal operations. And so we think the fix is not nearly as complicated as the task force is talking about. The fix is for Congress to correct the crisis that they created. And they can do away with the pre-funding obligation rather than restructure the post office, liberate the post office to be the post office. Is there room for innovation and opportunity for innovation? Absolutely. And we're 100% for that. But this is an albatross created and planned that nobody, no other agency or company could survive.
I do want to note, we did invite, again, note that we did invite Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, whose agency, whose department commissioned and compiled this report. We also invited the Postmaster General of the United States to join us for the program. Both declined, but we would love to speak to them at a future date. In the meantime, we'll get to some more of your comments. Matt wrote on our Facebook page, "Love my rural carrier job. Takes me all day, rarely take a break or eat lunch, held newborn babies and cried when my older customer friends passed. We run all day, and I love it. It takes a special person to do this job." Tamar in D.C. writes, "I love postal workers. My family was very close to ours when I was growing up. He was the first to hug me when I opened my college acceptance letter. Today, our mail carrier knows my kids and is actually a signatory on our will. Postal workers are such an important part of a community." Mark, could I ask you to react to these two? It seems like everyone's clear that it takes a special kind of person to work for the U.S. Post Office. What is that kind of person?
Oh, I don't know that it's a special person or not. We're mission-driven. Even with some of the hassles of long hours and night work and holiday work, we're very proud of the service that we provide the people of the country. I think whatever workers do, they're dedicated to it. I'm not sure we're any different than anyone else, except that the idea of public service and the mission is something that's part of our DNA. And I think these comments are just wonderful. I think it really underscores that the Postal Service and postal workers are a national treasure. And it's more than just putting a stamp on an envelope. There's so many hidden and invisible ways that postal workers and the Postal Service are part of the fabric of the country. And Josh, if I can quickly point out, you look at all these natural disasters and the fires and the floods and the hurricanes. Look who brings normalcy back. Oftentimes first to the
communities.
When
the mail comes back.
It's the postal workers.
Yeah. Michael emailed, "In the age of oil lamps, the Postal Service was absolutely necessary. But when was the last time you or your listeners sent a personal letter to someone? How many of the comments you received for today's show came by letter? My post box seems to be only for redundant paper bills and solicitation." Okay, Michael, but that might be a chance for us to take a look back at the post office in the days of oil lamps and otherwise. And joining us from NPR in New York to discuss that is Devin Leonard. He's a staff writer for Bloomberg Businessweek and the author of Neither Snow Nor Rain, A History of the United States Postal Service. Devin, welcome to 1A.
Hey, Joshua.
What did it look like in the early years of the Postal Service? Very different from today, I'm sure.
Well, it was different in so many ways. I guess it depends on where you want to start, but there's a lot of things that we sort of take for granted, stamps, for instance, home delivery, things like that, that just didn't exist for, you know, the first, 50 or 75 years, of the Postal Service. If you wanted your mail, you had to go to the post office, and stand in line. Or I guess if you were, lucky enough, you could send your servant or something like that. But it's just an entirely different experience.
Now, what is this about people mailing children? You won't have to explain that one to me.
Well, no, that actually happened. This is sort of in the pre-World War I era of the Postal Service. For a long time, the Postal Service hadn't been able to deliver packages. There was sort of a cartel of companies like Wells Fargo and American Express that sort of monopolized that business. And finally, President Taft, signed a bill allowing parcel delivery by the Postal Service. But unlike those private carriers, the Postal Service would pretty much carry anything, and people went to the post office and just, sent bricks. They sent pitchforks, all sorts of things just to see what the Postal Service would carry. I mean, literally, somebody sent a whole bank in pieces, through the mail. You can look that up on the Postal Service's
A bank?
Website. Yeah.
Like the building?
Yeah.
The money in it or just the building?
I don't know about the money, but it was definitely the building.
I'll take it if there's money in it. I will sign for that.
But in any case, so getting to children, there were people who decided, well, and this gets back to how much the Postal Service was trusted then,
right,
or in government in general. But it was cheaper to send your kid through the mail than to put them on a train. And some people did that. And eventually, the Postal Service, I think pretty quickly said, we have to stop that. But that happened. That's true.
Yeah, no, can't do that. I also understand, Devin, that the Postal Service had a reputation in the past as being a very innovative agency. It made front page news for its innovations. Is that right?
Well, that's another thing that's really interesting, because people don't associate the Postal Service with innovation now. But throughout its history, it was really innovative. They And each time there's a change in sort of technology in transportation technology, you know, the Postal Service hopped on that, whether it was steamboats or trains, and they created this whole system of train cars where the railway mail clerks sorted the mail on the train. They did it really fast, and they were this sort of esteemed branch of the Postal Service. Airmail, which was introduced in 1918, pretty much paved the way for the commercial airline industry, and sort of it goes on and on. And also another thing people don't know is that in the 70s, the Postal Service pioneered, pretty much electronic mail. It wasn't email. You'd take your mail to the post office and they'd scan it and send it electronically, and then a letter carrier would take it to your home. But they had a system like that in place, and big companies like AT&T, the telecom industry pushed back, and they shut it down.
Bob, what's your sense of whether today's post office has the latitude to innovate its way into the future? That's one of the concerns we've gotten from a number of listeners, that it's kind of too traditional, maybe even too insular, for the proper level of innovation to take place to really save the service.
Oh, it absolutely needs support to be able to be innovative. There's a lot of comment in the Treasury Task Force report about the risk of trying new services. I think the risk, Joshua, is if not being innovative, to have an institution like the Postal Service. And if you look around the world, in Ireland, they're talking about electric vehicles and testing them. In Italy, they're talking about financial services. But the idea that new technologies like blockchain and 3D printing, which UPS is experimenting with, are opportunities for the Postal Service to make a contribution is critical to the future.
And by the way, to the listener who asked about us getting mail, yes, we actually do. I get letters and cards from listeners all the time. And by the way, if you'd like to write to us, here's our address, 1A, care of WAMU, 4400 Massachusetts Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20016. One more time, 1A, care of WAMU, as in American University, 4400 Massachusetts Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20016. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. One listener tweeted, "I've lived in Colombia for several years. They have privatized mail. First advice I got was not to use the mail. Hardly anything ever arrived. Even now, we send cards to friends and relatives down there without sealing the envelope so that mail carriers can snoop, see there's no money, and maybe deliver it." Lena wrote on our Facebook page, "We are a military family, and there are times when mail sent through the U.S. Postal Service is the only contact my husband has to myself and the rest of his family. We appreciate their hard work, keeping us all connected." Devin, I know our time is short, but in terms of the history of the post office, was there a point at which things began to turn for the worse for the post office? I mean, it went from flying really, really high to kind of its current challenging state. Can we pinpoint a moment historically when that started?
Well, I guess you guys have talked about it a bit before, but I think in 2006, there was that law passed, as Bob said, I don't think the intentions were bad, but basically they saddled the Postal Service with this, huge, financial payment, every year. And then And really, the thing that really hurt the post office was that the financial crisis happened and people stopped paying their bills, through the mail. People had stopped really using the Postal Service for just, regular sort of personal communications. That had begun to fall off after World War II with the ubiquity of the telephone. But when people stopped paying their bills by the mail, through first-class mail, that really, really hurt. And that's something the Postal Service is still reeling from.
So, Mark, what do you do about this trend toward electronic communication? I don't think people are going to go back to writing physical letters anytime soon. How does the post office cope with this?
Well, I think that the Postal Service has a lot of opportunity for expanded and enhanced services. One is, look, there's also tons of letter mail. There's 500 million, half a billion pieces of day. That includes the packages, but that's largely mail. So it's not like there's not a lot of mail and it's not of value.
And we should also remember, we should also remember that according to many reports, 97 to 99% of all email is junk mail. Just to be clear, it's not all that people are just sending what they really mean to send. Go ahead, Mark.
So there are a number of areas. Obviously, e-commerce. And if e-commerce is going to work for everybody in this country, then you have to have the public infrastructure that goes to every address without surcharges because a package is going a further distance or a more remote area. And the post office doesn't have any of those. We also are big fans, and it's one of the problems with the task force report. We think the post office, the U.S. post office, should expand in much more into financial services and be a counter to this predatory payday lending, check cashing industry. We're trusted. We're everywhere. We've done it before for 60 years in this country. So there are many ways to innovate and to provide more services to bind the people together.
Bob, before we go, ideas for what the post office might do from here, briefly?
Well, one of the things that the task force recommended was that third parties, that entrepreneurs be able to do things with the Postal Service. They may have been talking about work sharing when they were talking about that, but the idea that the Postal Service can be a platform for public-private partnership is an opportunity that is just waiting for new experiments.
Robert Riesner, a management consultant at Guidehouse and a former president of the U.S. Postal Service. Rob, thanks for talking to us. Mark Demenstein, president of the American Postal Workers Union. Thank you, Mark. And
thank
Devin
you,
Leonard. And Devin Leonard, a staff writer for Bloomberg Businessweek and author of Neither Snow Nor Rain, A History of the United States Postal Service. Thanks, Devin.
Thanks, Joshua.
Hey, before we go, a few quick... Thank you very much, Bob. Before we go, a few quick deadlines if you're sending Christmas gifts through the post office. December 14th, last day to ship via USPS Retail Ground. If you wanted to use Priority Mail or First Class Mail, you should get it in before the 20th. If you're using Priority Mail Express, it's the 22nd. And today, December 11th, is the last day to ship to military addresses with an APO, FPO, or DPO prefix in time for Christmas. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.